The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Why'd you do it, kid?
She asked me to.
Obliging bastard. That the only reason you got, kid?
They shoot horses, don't they?
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Loose Cannons coming at you. Sorry for the delay in release dates. We had some trouble scheduling everyone together. People are on vacation, people are on work vacation. But what that means is we've got a new special guest host joining us today. If you'd like to introduce himself, secret guest host man.
Hi there, I'm Steven. I'm Severian140 on Twitter and Letterboxd. I like movies nearly as much as these guys.
I would say, considering your level of intense masochism,
oh,
you might
please.
Like them more than all of us combined. I don't think any of us have watched 70 hours of a director we really hate in one month.
These Romanian comedies aren't going to watch themselves, okay?
Come on, people, there's pre-code Hawks films to watch.
Can't wait for the podcast on Storm Children.
Callback. Alright, today we're going to be discussing 1969's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Directed by Sidney Pollack, one of our first director repeats, I think, if you don't include canon films.
No.
Awesome.
He did Condor, right?
Yep. Directed 3 Days of Condor. But before we do that, let's do this, a little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements. Patrick, kick us off.
Hey everybody, it's Patrick. Just wanted to say that this part of the audio is cut out. My recorder died on me in the middle of me doing my Herald. And so I don't have that bit of audio, so I'm just going to cut out my section and just say that I heralded Jun Ho Bong's 2006 film, The Host, which I watched at a get-together with some friends with the sound turned off, music playing in the background, and just followed along with the subtitles. And I'd like to say that it's a lot more hilarious than I remember it being when I watched it the first time 9 years ago. I also think that it's a lot more visually interesting than a lot of horror movies in that genre that I've seen. I think Jun Ho Bong's a great director and he has a great sense of humor. And I like the way that he mixes his commentary with really absurd and horrific elements, just like he did in his other films like Mother and Snowpiercer and Memories of Murder. So yeah, that was my Herald for this week.
How do you know that the music and sound effects of the movie doesn't make it less funny? Since you watched it silently.
Yeah. What if it's playing like a wacky Looney Tunes song in that moment? It's like...
Yeah. What if there's a laugh track after each moment like Friends?
I'm really glad you said since the last time you saw it 9 years ago, as I thought you were going to say I was best off for Stephanie Meyer novel.
I like Snowpiercer.
Yeah. You like your favorite movie of the year?
Yeah, I do. do like that movie.
I saw almost no movies that I like this last month, but I did finally see one that I liked yesterday, so I'll go ahead and herald Green Room by Jeremy Saulnier, even though I know that one person on this podcast doesn't like it, but I did.
Is it you?
Yeah, I'm heralding a movie I don't like.
Well, it must have been gotcha. A very bad month. This is the best movie I've seen all month, 2 stars.
But yeah, I think that he handles tension in a way that I think is pretty fun. Good editing. There are a couple of moments where like it got really grim and really dark, and then he would just throw this weird joke in there out of nowhere, and I laughed really loud. And I was like the only one in the theater. It was like silent and then me laughing really loud. And
always fun.
Yep. Yep. And it was shot here in Portland, which I was very excited about, but then he even subverted my expectation of that because it mostly just takes place in this one like weird like rickety den out in the woods. So I was like, oh, this doesn't look like Portland at all. Like, I was hoping for some cool Portland locations, but didn't even get that. It's pretty sweet. Yeah, that'd be really funny.
Best representation of Portland since Portland Street Blues, which takes place in Portland, Hong Kong.
Yep. So, depending on how good or bad the rest of the year goes, I might talk more about Green Room at the end of the year, but as it's right now my number 3 movie of the year, but if it's still in my top 10, this will mean that this year is significantly worse than last year, so.
And the year before that, right?
And the year before that, that's true. Steven?
Oh, well, I've noticed everyone has gone for Herald, so I think I should probably go for a denouncement.
Nice.
So, a couple of days ago, I saw a critically acclaimed 94% on Rotten Tomatoes thriller called Eye in the Sky. And I think it's probably the worst movie of the decade. There was not a single thing the movie did that I liked in any way. I thought its grip of the current political zeitgeist was incredibly naive. It made Spectre look like it was directed by Alan J. Pakula. I just hated every single choice in it, and watching it made me incredibly depressed throughout. And when I got back to my flat, I started to positively, like, reconsider all the movies I've been watching up to that point. So, I guess it did that. Actually, this is more of a Herald, isn't it? I'll be quiet. Oh, maybe movies aren't so bad after all.
That's good because I already said that Spectre is not as good a take on the modern political zeitgeist as The Rock driving an ambulance into a drone.
What's better than that, though?
But we've established a very clear hierarchy of political zeitgeist.
I was actually thinking you saying that. Spectre, like, yeah, this is worse.
The sky below that.
I have one herald and 2 denouncements since I, unlike Basil, feel very confident that my herald is going to make my end of the year list, even though it's a movie from 2006. I'll save that, I'll keep it in my pocket, and I'll denounce a movie either called April in the Extraordinary World or April in Her Twisted World, depending on where you saw it. I think.
Nice.
It's an animated film that takes place in an alternate present where Napoleon dies, never invades Russia, and is taken over by his son, who just makes a peace treaty, and then in a sort of unrelated storyline, like scientists start getting kidnapped, and so technology never advances past the Napoleonic age, and so everything is like steampunk in the present instead of how it is now. And sort of I came into this movie and like sat down, and within about 2 seconds I was like, oh no, I'm not gonna like this, because I thought the animation was really bad, and then it only really got worse from there. There's no real characters in it, like not even like in the sense of being like a Star Wars where, you know, there's a character who's just like has like one quality. Like they don't even have like one quality. Like I couldn't even name something that defines any of these people at the center except for like scientists or like lost their parents, I guess. And then like there's like a mystery at the center, I guess, about the scientists being disappearing from the world, but like it's so overtly hinted at what's going on that I feel like you pretty much know as soon as they say scientists are disappearing what has happened. And I'm like, I guess that would be like fine for a kid's movie, also the character thing, if that's what this movie is going for, but there's also like a part where like people are electrocuted to death on screen, and I'm like, is this a kid's movie? So I mean, I still wouldn't think it was a good kids movie, but at least I would understand like its place in the world if that were the case. But it doesn't feel like a kids movie in certain other ways, so it just feels really, really bad.
Yeah, that movie just started playing at the theater that I work at, and it's doing super well. People keep coming out and being like, "Ah, have you seen this yet? It's really good." And they're mostly like old people. I guess that part of the Portland is a bunch of old people who really just want to watch children's movies, but want to watch international ones so that they...
Well, it's not April anymore, so it's going to have to plummet now.
That's true.
Who directed that? Do you know?
I don't know. I'll click around.
I know that the
some noise with my keyboard.
The poster says very prominently, "From the producers of Persepolis."
Always a good sign. God, no.
when they have to reach back and be like,
Ekinichi and Christian Damaris.
Never heard of them.
Are they like in the Loop? Because I thought that would be like in the Loop Besson party. Because Luc Besson did a movie called The Extraordinary Adventures of Adeline Blanksack, which I think is still in my top 25 worst movies of all time, and the poster just reminded me of that. I was like, oh, no.
I have no idea. They're first-time directors, according to Letterboxd.
Oh. Better luck next time.
Yeah. I would say the only thing that I liked about the movie is Marion Cotillard's performance as the lead. As per usual, she's good, although I also found it kind of distracting when I was watching the movie, because like I went into it not knowing anything about it, including who was in it, and I was like, who is that voice? I recognize it. And so I spent like an hour of the movie being like, do I know that person? What French actors do I know?
Not that many, so.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. See ya, April.
Goodbye, April. Hello, May. Mm-hmm. Hello. They shoot horses, don't they? Okay, so this movie takes place during the Depression at a thing that existed, although I assume that this is somewhat an exaggeration of what they were actually like, called dance contests, where people would gather to win large sums of money, and basically, although it's called a dance contest, essentially the idea is you have to stand up for almost days on end with like little rest, and whoever stands up the longest wins money. At the center of this tale is Michael Sazerin, I believe is his name, and Jane Fonda, who are like, he's just like wandering through, and her partner for the dance contest gets eliminated because he has bronchitis. And so they just sort of randomly get paired up, and then the film sort of follows the two of them through the dance contest and the trials and tribulations of the depression and participating in that dance contest. I guess we'll get into more specifics as we go, but Patrick, what did you think of this?
Considering that I just lost my file for the beginning of this podcast, because my batteries went dead and now I can't play the other file in it, so this is going to be the first time you're hearing my voice on the podcast. I like this movie. I thought this movie was really great. I thought it did a lot of amazing things. I really like the cinematography in it. I kind of like am not that big a fan of like complete and total cynicism, but this movie, I don't know, it's so devoted to the idea of like being cynical about the world in a way that seems it seems to play well against the facade that the movie is constantly trying to, or the people in the competition are trying to put up. Like, they're always playing kind of, you know, upbeat, happy music, and the announcer is so like joyous, and he's always saying yowza, 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 and it's just like everything underneath it is so dark and, you know, horrible. And you know, even the scenes where they're supposed to be like entertaining the crowd are just like the most horrible like human suffering in them. And I really liked that that juxtaposition, I guess, that it did throughout.
I feel somewhat in the middle in this movie. There's a period of time where I liked it, but as it went on, there's for the last like half hour, I was kind of like, no, all right, like that. I feel like, I don't know, this is like one of the least subtle movies maybe ever, like for a pretty well-made movie. Like almost right away, there's like a guy saying something about our great leader Herbert Hoover tells you to, and it feels very much like a movie from the 60s looking back and being like, ah, the Depression, it was so horrible. Look how horrible it was to be in the Depression. And that the movie's kind of like that for the whole thing. And I really like Jane Fonda's performance, and I like some of the moments a whole lot, but that at a certain point, it's like heaping so much on me that I was like, oh, I don't know that I feel anything that strongly anymore, which is maybe the point. Maybe it was trying to wear down my emotions. It's a meta game until I'm indifferent to their suffering. But
I kind of felt that as well.
But yeah, I don't know. I watched this once before, and I feel basically the same about it that I did then, where I was like, well, that was pretty good, I guess. Steven?
I'd have to say my opinion's probably a mix between yours and Patrick's. I like the movie a lot, but I felt that, like, I was thinking in my head, like, I don't like this about a movie, I don't like that about a movie. And then I thought about it more, and it's actually, that probably plays into the movie's strengths. Like, there were times where I was just, like, so inebriated to what was going on. There's a particular, like, stretch in the middle where I felt like I was watching The Turing Horse at one point. But it's just, that probably goes into, like, the theme of, like, the repetitive, like, nature of, like, the strain and the depression era and allegories, etc. I couldn't really, like, decide, like, whether my boredom was a, well, not boredom, but, diminishing interest was a good thing or not. I'd say it was overall a positive experience, definitely, but the finer details just I had trouble processing a lot of what was going on. Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. This is my pick, part of my annual rewatches list. This was one of my favorite movies in the past, one of my 5-star ratings, but I don't feel that strongly about it anymore. I still like it, but I found it to be a lot more arch than I remembered it, in particular the performance of Alice, the actress. I was thinking about how Ilya was kind of talking about it on the end of the year podcast when we were talking about Greta Gerwig and Mistress America, and that she feels like someone who acts arch because she thinks that's like an interesting way to be, and like you can see like the separation from maybe like a character underneath that and like this arch presentation that she's putting on, whereas in this case it just feels arch. Like, I understand that, like, that's sort of what's supposed to be going on, that she's, like, maybe, like, appealing to, like, this acting, like, fancy culture or whatever, but it never really works for me. And another thing that I never liked about, I didn't like about the film the first time I saw it, but didn't bother me, was, like, the structure, like, the cutting back and forth between, I guess, the ending of the movie and like the meat of it, but this time it did. I was like, I don't know, I had always felt like it would grind what was going on to a halt and be like weirdly dreamlike in a way that didn't super make sense to me, but I still found most of the rest of the acting good. Like, I feel like Gig Young does the same thing but is actually more successful, where there's like this level between like the performance and like the character, I like a lot of the side people as well, especially Bonnie Bedelia and Bruce Dern as like the pregnant couple, and there are some really really like still moments that like hit me really hard, but there's also a lot of stuff in between those moments that I'm kind of indifferent to or even negative on. So yeah, kind of a disappointment that I don't love it as much as I used to, but I mean, I guess I still really like it. It's the category I would put it in.
I'm glad you brought up the crisscrossing structure, because that was something I felt quite a lot during the movie. Like, I was trying to imagine, like, what would this movie be like if you cut out all of the scenes after the like first 5 minutes where he walks into the dance arena. What if it was like a 90 minute movie which just stayed in that arena, kind of like taking a more like stage play approach to it? I kept thinking that, like, something like for top of my head, like Roman Polanski's Carnage or something, where it all takes place in one scene, and maybe, and like if you did that, you can kind of keep things in, like, you'd get a better sense of just how tired these people are as you follow them in like a sped up version of real time. Or maybe you could do the opposite route and like make the movie like five, six hours long, where you make it a slow burn as you
definitely
really
ladder.
Just see these people's like a Lav Diaz movie, basically, like Enchantos.
Your favorite director?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just like the slow burn on these characters, and I felt like at 2 hours I was feeling its length, but maybe at 3 hours I could come back to it in like a new light during the movie, but take what we can get.
Yeah, I can see that. And yeah, I think that there's no reason to have the like flashing forward to him in prison, except for like, out of fear that the audience is getting bored of watching dancing or whatever, that because it makes it apparent so quickly what happens. Like, they're like trying to hint at it, but it's still just like, okay, so like they're only talking to him, so the other main character must be dead because they're not talking to her. And so, like, I don't know, I feel like it's forefronting everything so much that I mean, I guess there's a level of fatalism to it that it brings, which could be interesting, but I definitely feel like it doesn't pull it off at all.
Yeah, I'll go in defense of that, and I will say that I guess I'm the audience member who needed it to be broken up a little bit, because I didn't mind it. I didn't mind a little like respite here and there. And I'll also say that I like a while ago had like read the first few pages of the book while I was like sitting around bored on a film shoot one time. And so the first few pages of the book actually like kind of give away the ending. So I already knew it was going to happen even before I went into the movie. And, you know, just seeing that reiterated, like, I don't know, it didn't necessarily bother me at all. And it did kind of break up the structure a little bit. And so, sorry. But yeah, I didn't mind it that much, honestly. It didn't do a lot for me, but it also didn't distract me from the rest of the movie. I was still in it pretty much for most of it.
Whoa. Did anyone else see that happen with Basil's face?
No. What happened to my face?
Okay. It like kept cutting back and forth between like different positions, like it was like really choppy. Cool. And it looked really creepy, like an old 90s like special effect of like someone being like
awesome. Oh, I was gonna say I'm glad that I ended up liking the movie as much as I did, because I hated the opening, like when it's like in the field and there's like slow motion of the horse falling down. Oh, I was like, this is terrible.
I actually
I kind of like when it calls it back at the end though.
Yeah, I mean, what? I liked
when
the music.
Like
was
she's falling there in real life, and then she's falling in the.
In the field. I don't like that part either.
I was expecting the theme from Days of Heaven to start when that happens. I kind of like Whispering Monitor. The only thing I thought of during the opening was how much that guy kept reminding me of Antoine Donnell from 400 Blows. Because, like, there's the scene where he's walking away from the scene. The sea, and then he goes into the house. I don't have any serious movie thoughts, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's he is standing in front of the ocean. Looking like
one thing that I liked more this time though than the previous time that I watched it is Michael Sarrazin's performance, which I was kind of indifferent to.
Oh yeah.
I sort of wish the film would focus more on Jane Fonda the first time that I watched it, but this time I was pretty into his like weird detached, like not nihilism, because like he's always trying to like catch like bits of like the sun and stuff like that, so he's obviously like, I don't know, invested in life in a way, but
also super detached from it at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like his performance too, and his sort of like strange deadpan delivery that's like not ironic deadpan, it's just like this weird, like, dissociated. It's uncomfortable. I think it's pretty cool. Yeah. I feel like it's a performance that it'd be really hard to get somebody to do nowadays, that it's, like, unselfconscious and yet, like, so dead. It's pretty sweet.
It's like he has the most authority in the movie, and yet he's so defeated in every scene he's in. Like, he's just given up at that point.
So speaking of how tired everyone looks, I will say though that I think what's her name in The Babadook is the best stealth reigning champion of looking super tired,
right?
Like looking impressively tired in a movie.
Yeah, there was a point with the makeup in the movie where I was like, oh man, this is really good. But then once they get to the end, I was like, oh, they've gone a little too far, maybe. Like, Jane Fonda looks super crazy in the very final scene. So they just, like, make her hair into this giant nest.
Yeah.
They've been dancing for how many days, and all they had to eat was, like, hot dogs and stuff. Like, it's gotta be, like, the worst thing to eat when you're trying to dance. Like, I would just want to vomit
it's
all
true.
The time.
Yeah, they talk about their...
I think they've been dancing for 6,000 days.
Yeah. Or whatever
they've
it was.
They've been dancing for 19 years.
Yeah.
19 years for $750.
Without taxes.
The part that was like super like degrading to me was when they would one of them would go up and dance and then people would just throw pennies at them. I was just like, oh my god, that's the worst.
Yeah. Actually, the woman who is like their sponsor, who likes them as a couple or whatever, is the. Like, the other part of the audience is again, like, a little too arch for me. Like, when it cuts to, like, their faces and they're like, nah! Like, I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. But, like, when it cuts to the woman who's, like, super concerned for them, like, especially when they're broken up, and it's, like, during the part of the dance contest when they're, like, on roller skates and, like, the last three couples get eliminated, and it's, like, cutting back and forth between, like, her concerned face, I'm like, oh, this is me watching this movie. Like, I'm this old lady or whatever who's, like, having this emotional catharsis that's enjoyable for me while these other people are like super like awful suffering or whatever. And it's like, my original reading of this film and my first review for Letterboxd does still stand, and then it makes you feel really awful about being the type of person who watches movies. And I'm like, fair enough.
Yeah.
Though it's for a podcast, it doesn't count.
Have to go through to, like, yeah,
it's true.
It's interesting though. Like, I am actually working on a movie, and the last shooting day we had went like 14 and a half hours, and I could like feel a little bit of that in this movie. I was like, man, these people are exhausted. And I was like, it feels like when I was like standing around for 14 and a half hours, like making that movie. Like, everybody was tired and angry at each other. We're just like. I was like, that's kind of how it feels to make a movie sometimes, where you're just like, oh, when is this going to end? And, like, you know, there's a lot of people over you who are making a lot of money off of what you're doing, and, yeah. it's a metaphor for several different things, I feel.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I think we can all relate as people who have been tired before to this movie about people dancing for a month straight. Without sleeping.
Yeah. Like, I too have felt sadness.
I hope someone remakes this in like a couple of years at a giant rave party. Get rid of the roller skates, Heaven's Gate
with,
years ago.
Like, Dakota Fanning or Hailee Steinfeld is the Gloria role.
Yep.
Step up 7 hours long.
Get Channing Tatum to be the MC.
That would actually be really good.
Yeah.
The other movie besides The Babadook that I kept thinking, or I guess also books while I was watching this, was The Hunger Games. And I was like, this reminds me both thematically and even sort of in the main character with like her really outward level of cynicism, but that like once you scratch the surface there's like a really defeated like optimism and like romanticism underneath is The Hunger Games. And then once I realized how much this reminded me of The Hunger Games, I couldn't stop thinking about how I like The Hunger Games better, which made it harder to enjoy this movie.
Well,
oop. Wow.
A bunch of people talking all at once and then deferring to each other.
Yeah, I think it's hard because I think we have a delay going on, so some of us like don't hear the other person until we've already started talking.
Completely unrelated to anything. I didn't realize until I saw this movie the first time how old disco balls are. I assumed they were like invented in the 70s, but they had them all the way back in the late 1920s.
What did they call them?
Just called them like, I don't know. Mirror balls, I think is what they were called. Mm. Mm.
Did they call them discotheque balls? Because yeah. It hadn't been shortened yet?
Flapper balls.
Light spheres. The one movie.
The one true eye of God.
Wait. Oh, someone's going to find an Illuminati reference in this.
People found Illuminati references.
Sidney Pollack, Illuminati, was in Eyes Wide Shut, confirmed. The one movie I kept thinking of was, especially in the way that it uses dance to portray, like a political zeitgeist, like what this did with the Depression, was Carlos Sauer's Blood Wedding, which is a movie that it's very like structural. Like the first half of the movie is like these troupe of flamenco dancers like learning how to perform a dance to the audience, and then in the second half the full dance is performed in its entirety. And I kept thinking about that, like, metaphorical structure and how, like, They Shoot Horses does that with a more, excuse the terrible term, Americanized narrative, like that kind of, like, Hollywood narrative, and how it, like, puts that into, something that would define a more American movie of like the late 60s and such.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't think anyone has.
I have not. I want to see more Carlos Sauer movies because I liked one a lot and another not so much. But
I recommend that and Faster. Good movies.
I was going to say the sequence that I guess stands out the most to me is the derby sequence, which I guess is supposed to be like a big high point in the movie anyway, but just the...
By high point, you mean low point,
I mean,
right?
That's what I mean. I mean, like, the dramatic, like, a really big, like, dramatic scene, but it is one of the most, like, terrifyingly sad things that I've ever seen, just because of... I guess it's heightened by how enthusiastic... Rollo the announcer is about everything that's going on, how he's trying to make it like, you know, like it's a horse race, and you just see the faces of these people and just like hear them screaming and falling over each other, and even the guy on the roller skates, like it looks so dangerous to me. I'm just like, he's probably crushing so many people's fingers when he's like skating around by these fallen bodies. It was just everything about it was horrible, and I was just like watching it just like
Yeah, that was something that I didn't notice the first time I watched it that I noticed this time that I really like, is that like all those guys in like tuxes look like mafia lackeys. Like
yeah,
they don't
yeah, they do.
Like they're dressed up like super nice, like this is like a, you know, like an entertainment thing, like fun or whatever, like a black tie affair or something, but they look like they could throw you out on your ass in like a second, and like super intense and like scowly and unpleasant. And it's like this weird dichotomy between like them wearing like the ref's uniform, but then they're like really muscly and like angry looking, or wearing the tuxedo.
Yeah.
I thought that was a cool, more subtle thing than some of the rest of the film, which is not subtle.
Yeah, I was gonna say that on paper I really like the derby idea, but I actually don't like the stylistic execution where like the first time we see it, they like do a lot of over cranking or under cranking where like it's like clearly fast motion and like gives it kind of like a like ironic slapsticky feel that I didn't quite like. And then the second time we get it, it's like all in slow motion, and I was like, now it feels overwrought in the opposite way. I don't know if I, like, I think it would just be like more interesting to just see these awful people like having to like move their bodies in real time really quickly while trying to shove each other out of the way in this sad desperation. But
yeah, but I mean, I guess it's another point where the movie reminds you that you are watching a movie and you are kind of doing the same thing that the audience is doing watching these people. So I kind of liked that. I kind of liked that it reminded me, it was like, oh yeah, by the way, this is all like something that is being, you know, portrayed for your entertainment as well, as, you know, the, it's like unifying you with the audience watching the people in the arena too. So I kind of liked that. So it was like holding up a mirror there for a second.
A mirror ball?
A mirror ball, yeah. A giant mirror ball reflecting your own desire for entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So there was a subtle layer to it.
I was going to do a Joaquin Phoenix impression in Gladiator, but... Are you not entertained?
Oh, that's actually Russell Crowe that says that.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I'm sorry, yeah. I don't have my Gladiator knowledge.
They should have had Jane Fonda say that in this movie.
That's true. I only know that because that was one of the first DVDs I owned, and so me and my brother watched. We may have watched every single special feature that has ever been put on Gladiator. About Gladiator.
Even though there was like 9 hours of special features for the Toy Story box set, I watched all of them because I got it the week before I got my wisdom teeth removed. Nice. So I was just in bed and I just watched 9 hours of...
Have you seen Toy Story of Terror? It's like the only good Predator sequel. It's just Predator
this
with
is,
toys.
The box set came out the Toy Box or whatever, it was just Toy Story 1 and 2. I got my wisdom teeth removed in high school, which was 15 years ago at this point.
Nice.
So, way predating Toy Story 3 and Toy Story of Terror.
Oh yeah, something that I did think was cool and subtle, there's just like one shot in the middle of the movie that I thought was like a really cool way of highlighting like the absence of people of color. There's like one shot of like a black janitor and he just like cleaning something in the corner and then he just leaves the room and you're like, oh yeah, it's just a bunch of white people because this is 1929.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I was like, oh, that's, yeah. It's like pointed because they hold that shot for so long of that guy. And he's just like looking so downtrodden, like just carrying garbage cans out. And I was like, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. But one thing,
even within this horrible spectacle, black people are excluded.
I think the one thing I noticed when, especially there's like the scenes of all of them gathering together, is that I don't think there's a like single main actor or actress in this movie who didn't have blue eyes. Like, there's a scene where they're all looking at each other and it's just like they cut to each other so sporadically, but their eyes look exactly the same. It's really bizarre, and it probably wasn't intentional, but just looking at that, it's just like, am I missing something here, or was this just a really odd like cutting choice for these shots? Or
you didn't remember how everyone had blue eyes until 1929?
Yep.
And then,
oh yeah, of course.
It's historically accurate. Yeah. Then other types of eyes were invented.
They had to cut them all in by hand.
Everyone was like bored. They're like, enough of the blue already.
Like, that's that attention to detail that matters.
A moment I really liked is when I keep forgetting the character's name, Michael Sarrazin's
Robert.
Robert,
yeah.
Yeah. When Robert steps in when Bruce Dern is about to start a fight with with Gloria. Jane Fonda's Gloria, and she's like, "Why? What'd you do that for?" She's like, "Face on that corn pone. He could have killed you," or something like that. And he goes, "You're my partner." And there was like something both like really touching about that, and at the same time, like the only reason that they have any relationship whatsoever is because they were like forced together, and then like it's such a terrible situation that like you'll seek the comfort of anybody, and that, you know, like how easily it falls apart at the end, sort of. And it, you know, it never feels like they're friends or potentially romantically involved or anything for any reason other than like their geographic closeness, right, in a way. Like there's nothing like in common, or like there's not like a shared moment between them or something. Mm-hmm. And it, that part like really hit me. And then like even thinking about it like more now, like you could even extend that to like a commentary on movies as well, that it's like, oh, here are these two main characters, so they get together because that's what happens. Right. But in this movie, it like kind of draw, it's like that happens in this movie, they get together because that's what happens, but then you kind of watch it and you're like, but why do they get together? Yep. Or and why do they fall apart, and why is she so hurt when, you know, he almost sleeps with her, or does sleep with that other woman? Like,
wow.
What do they have together?
Yep.
I think I understand why this reminds you of The Hunger Games now.
I would,
well, the whole audience spectacle thing, yeah. And yeah, the like forced relationship, yeah, and
in order to survive, like they need to get their partners in order to dance.
And just Gloria as a character reminds me of Katniss a lot. Mm.
Makes sense.
I was wondering why I liked her so much, because I was just like, I really like this character. She's like, she's super harsh, and I don't know why I enjoy
Fonda's that. Performance,
like,
is really good too.
Yeah, I feel like
I kind of, in retrospect, I like it now, but at the beginning when the movie started, I was like, she's like so overt, I kind of don't like this. But then like I was like, oh right, that's because like this cynicism is like in some ways like a front that she's put on to protect herself from like the horrible situation. And then at the end when she's being cynical, it, you know, feels a lot more like now she's actually like given up, like the cynicism is really buried deep in her in a way.
It's real now
at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's complex in a way that a lot of female roles at that time probably weren't. So it's
the 60s were pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, this is like right at the beginning of New Hollywood, I guess. So it's changed.
I mean, I would say that probably equally as rare as they are now. Yeah. Maybe slightly more rare. I mean, intricate.
Yeah, Stephen and I were talking about it.
Hard to find in general.
Before the podcast started, that until she started talking, I wasn't sure that it wasn't Faye Dunaway, because I couldn't remember who was in the movie.
I had like the exact same person. Different Bonnie and Clyde references I was gonna make during this, and I've now got to scrap all of them. I'm really embarrassed. I wanted to ask what you thought of the mental breakdown in the shower scene shortly after the final derby race, because
I used to like it and I don't anymore.
I kind of
like Gig Young in that scene, but I do not like Susanna.
That's the scene that stuck out the most for me, not necessarily that I liked it, just for one that's like impacted me the most on this viewing, like the contrast between the characters and how it's like fed into the narrative, and so many feelings. I just couldn't really pass, like, it seemed very like that kind of like scene felt kind of unnatural for like the tone they were going for, but at the same time, that was like, it's an expression of what was going on, even if it wouldn't look out of place in Carrie, and God.
I think that the woman freaking out about the bugs actually works better for me, in the sense that it's like, I mean, for one, like, a real thing that sleep deprivation causes, like, hallucinations, which is terrifying, mm-hmm. that, like, you're, like, if you don't sleep, your brain will start seeing things that aren't there. That's really scary. Mm-hmm. And,
well, yeah, it's like you have to dream, and so if you don't dream, you will just start dreaming in real life, essentially, is what's happening.
And that's horrifying. Everybody's
like, all right, dream time.
Yeah. Well, I also, but that, well, I was going to say, oh, what were you going to say, Basil? Finish what you were saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just that I think that that scene has a better closure, because then there's the part where Gloria talks to him, and she's sort of like snarkily being like, oh, surprised you didn't put her out there. And that Gig Young says it's too real, and that's like this weird idea of like the showmanship is that you have to see these people suffering, but it's like a fun suffering. It's like the it's like hopeful suffering where they're like, oh, look how hard they're trying. They're exhausted. They're trying really hard for you, though.
I was also going to say, I found it weird how like kind of compassionate Gig Young is in that scene toward the woman, because he's like, it's almost like he's been there, he's seen all this before, and he's, you know, he's still like, you know, the cynical showman who's like, oh, I'm not going to put that out there for the audience. But he's also like doing stuff. He's not like just like snap out of it. He's like going along with her hallucination. He's like, all right, I'm going to get the bugs off of you. I'm going to clean you off. It's like, you're okay. You're okay. And he's like being really compassionate and like helping her out of it in a way that nobody else really is in that scene. And it's weird, that kind of like compassion. And then you see the like dispassionate, like, oh, I couldn't put that on there in front of my audience. So I liked that juxtaposition of that character as well.
Yeah, but I think that that like kind of hints at just an unsettling pragmatism within human nature, that like he's motivated to be compassionate because the show has to keep going. So like he's,
that's how I feel.
Yeah, that he's in a way he's like doing something that is pretty nice for this person, but with the ulterior motive that like, if he doesn't do this nice thing, then they'll have to like stop his job. So
yeah,
it's kind of creepy. Yeah.
But I appreciate that, though. Like I found that dichotomy mm-hmm. to be interesting. And so
no, I wasn't saying that as a negative about the movie at all. I think that's really cool and also gross about humanity. That like, you know, I don't know, like doctors are doing really great things, but a lot of doctors are probably doing really great things because they love really great paychecks and stuff like that. True. But they're still like helping people, so like it's a weird thing.
That's true. What were you gonna say, Ruben?
Yeah, I was gonna say that's the part when he's like, it's too real, is probably the part that reminds me the most of the Hunger Games, and like how, you know, they like kill these children, but then they have these like ceremonies or whatever to like celebrate their deaths as if they're not the causes right. of their death. Like, you know, they sound like that horn or whatever, and then their face appears in the sky and they're like, do 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 do. It's like it's like, wait. And so everyone's like, oh, that's so sad that they died, as if like they couldn't have stopped them from dying. And yeah, and it's like you add this level of unreality to it that it makes it like a show, so that you don't really care about the people who are suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I used to think that the sailor dying part was pretty intense and really awful to watch, but it affected me a little less this time. I actually think that the scene right before that where he's asleep and they just dump him in ice water is a lot more brutal and horrifying.
I mean I feel like when he dies, the thing that affects me is like thinking on that moment when she was just dragging a body.
Yeah, yeah, that part around is really upsetting.
And I'm like, oh god. But then yeah, the part where he like collapses into her lap, and you know, she freaks out, and then Gig Young tries to cover for it, where he's like, he's okay. Yeah. Doctors say it's just some exhaustion or whatever. Yeah, that I agree that that's not quite as good.
I don't know. I kind of like
the people you live with, Patrick, are really good at slamming doors.
Oh, I mean, Joe.
Oh, come on, I'm not ruining your podcast.
You are. You're ruining it. It's ruined. It's ruining the podcast. Sorry.
No, it's all good.
There's.
Speaking of ruining the podcast, can you thank him for doing my job for me?
Sorry.
Even though it won't have like us in it, I kind of want you to re-record your Herald and just cut
yeah,
it in there.
I'm probably going to. I'm probably just going to like sit down and because I've got all this recording equipment here anyway. Although I didn't bring my normal bag that I usually record with because we're using Joe's bag on this one, so that's why I had just batteries in it instead of my charging thing. So my batteries are lithium batteries and they last a lot longer, but when they die, it's like immediate. Instead of like wearing
no warning,
yeah. So that sucked.
I can record for 2 hours about how bad I am the sky is if you want.
Just send me all of that audio over. I'll put it somewhere.
Oh, I forgot about. I really like the part in the beginning though with Sailor when it's like a pretty obvious like Gene Kelly reference to Anchors Away or whatever, where he's like doing this big tap routine,
yeah.
And being like, ah, like in your face, guys. I'm so unafraid of being tired. I'm gonna really exert myself for no reason right now.
That's probably the thing that kills him.
He's thinking of Fred Astaire doing that, and it's just like, I'm gonna do all of it in 5 minutes, and oh, I'm gone. Bye.
Yep. I like how they were like, you know, they were like throwing people out for all sorts of reasons, but then like the pregnant lady and like the old man, he's like, you're 31? And he's like, and he's like, yeah. And he's like, it's your feet, Sailor. And it's like, y'all can come in. No probs.
It's a good story. A guy with bronchitis is not a good story, but pregnant lady trying to get $1,500 to support her child.
Depression over was strictly a millennial only affair.
Man, if only they'd kept going. Maybe they do, since we never see the end. Maybe she gives birth during the.
That was what got me. That's what I thought was going to happen at one point. I was like, oh, she doesn't know how far along she is. Like, she could be having that baby any day now.
Yeah, that's not that, but what Basil just sort of offhandedly mentioned is one thing that I actually really, really like about this movie is the final shot and the actual ending of the movie is just back in the dance hall, the like whatever 15 couples who are still in it doing it.
Yep.
And it's, you know, he's just being like, Elza, Elza, Elza.
Yeah.
Even a person being murdered outside
dead.
Can't.
That's really
the Sailor is dead.
That's really.
And I was like, this is a really sad shot.
That's really interesting, given as what I skim read, that's the only part that's not in the book. Like, the book just ends with they shoot horses, don't we? But this movie has, like, the bookended scene at the end, which I agree, I thought was one of the stronger parts of them just like continuing onwards for a prize that's worth barely anything at the end. I thought it was like one of the movie's stronger moments.
It's a really
I like how he says he's not going to charge the non-winners.
He's not trying to cheat anybody. Yeah,
I'm not going to charge
because
anyone.
He said, because I'm not trying to scam anyone. Well, what is the prize money then, if not a scam?
It's true.
That's the scam. Scammer. You damn scammer.
Well, $1,500 is a lot of money, and given that you can buy one admission and stay as long as you like, they're not making that money back with the audience, probably.
Yeah, this reminds me of, I don't know, something like, I guess like collegiate sports or something like that, where you have a bunch of people who are ostensibly like poor people who get money to come to your school, and it's a little bit of money, but you're making way more money off of them performing for you. And so, you know, but
and they're taking all the risk.
They're taking all the risk, and they're putting their bodies on the line to make a lot more money for you than you're giving to them. And you're also like deducting all these costs, because I mean, that's essentially what giving somebody a scholarship is. It's just like, all right, you being able to go to our school is worth this much, so we're just going to tell you that that's so, and you can't contest that that is true or not.
You're getting paid $30,000 a year, but I only get $10 a week in my pocket. It's like, yeah, your classes are $1,500 a semester. Enjoy them. But I go to two-a-days. I literally fall asleep in every one of my classes.
I do like paying for textbooks.
The college experience.
It won't go away.
And you're... Hope you enjoy they found that out useless something that degree like... when we kick you out of our team.
Yeah, when you break your...
They found something like 80% of college football players as their language requirement takes Swahili.
Yeah, wasn't that at North Carolina or something?
Oh, everywhere.
Is it everywhere?
Like literally everywhere.
I thought that was at a specific school.
Nope.
Is that just because it's a language to get a easy to get a high grade in, or is that just like the standard?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they can hide it being really they don't like it, because no one else is taking Swahili. Mm-hmm. It's a trick for the like, you know, they're like, did you learn anything in Swahili? And they're like, can you say something in Swahili? They're like, no. Like, you know, like the exam is like, what language did you learn? It's like Swahili, and then I don't even know the answer to this, but I'm sure they did. It's like, what country is Swahili from?
Right.
Speak I'm looking it forward to
like Kenya.
Like a couple of years time, everyone's going to be catching up to us. Like, okay, we're going to move to Urdu, and then we're going to move to Tamil, and then we're just going to like keep beating them.
People are catching on to Swahili. We got to think of another obscure language to teach our athletes.
Swahili becomes really popular.
Or pay them, whatever.
Well, that's not going to happen, though. You're living in a dream world, Ruben. We're never going to... These are student athletes. They're doing it for the love of the game.
That reminds me of...
Uncorrupted by money.
That reminds me of... I had dinner with one of the crew members, and for some reason or another, like, the sound mixer I work with, he's a socialist, and this guy was like trying to talk about like capitalism and stuff like that, and we ended up having an argument about whether or not the minimum wage was supposed to be a living wage for people. And I was like, yes, that's literally what the minimum wage is supposed to be. And he's like, no it's not. And I was like,
I had a similar fight on Facebook recently, and it was pretty fruitless, and I regretted immediately that I engaged in it.
At least I had a nice dinner.
I think Ruben got disconnected.
I don't know. He's just smiling forever. Ruben finds everything we say funny. Isn't that right, Ruben? Ruben. I wish people could see the smile on Ruben's face right now. It's really funny.
He's currently learning Swahili. It's just picking off a dictionary off a shelf and going through random words.
Well,
let me find out what hello, welcome to Loose Cannons is in Swahili.
Yeah.
Do it.
Let's include all our international listeners.
Yeah.
All our student athlete listeners.
Hello, kuwaka barishi waka kwa skriptosuru.
Welcome back.
Alright, well, now that my computer is doing that thing where it randomly shuts off, and we're talking about collegiate sports instead of the movie, maybe it's time to wrap it up, unless people have more stuff they want to say about They Shoot Horses, don't they?
I think we're good to go.
Run through it.
Alright, first, of course, want to thank Steven for joining us to discuss a movie.
Thank you for having me.
Oh yeah, before we officially end, I was gonna say that Steven and I were joking before the podcast that we should try and make this our longest ever as like a comment, a meta commentary.
They're still going. The yowza, yowza, yowza. I mean, that's what the end of the year podcasts feel like.
If y'all want to do that, you're welcome to, but I have work at 5 and I kind of want to take a nap.
I'm going hiking.
I have work.
Yeah, I'm going hiking at 1, so gotta get out of here.
All right.
I'm going to write 300 lines of code that won't work.
Also, it sounds like fun.
We've all got great plans for this Sunday afternoon. All right, sorry for the interruption.
We can meet back at a future time and continue to discuss this movie more at length. And just pretend that we've been doing it nonstop.
It's
true. Released like a 25-hour podcast recorded in 8 parts.
Nice.
All right, if you are listening to and enjoying the podcast, you can always subscribe to us using your podcast listening app. Rate and review us on iTunes. And visit our website, loosecannons.net, LOOSECANONS.net, to find all of our content, videos, writings, and of course, the podcasts for all your podcast needs.
Woo!
If all your podcast needs are just listening to our podcast.
Yep.
Which they should be.
That's true.
All right. I guess that is it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.